Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The silly season has evaporated into inanity. The sober season grasps us by the scrotum, the collective scrotum, the public pubis, as it were. The kids are back in school, and if any semblance of sanity and justice yet prevails, most of them will march on Fridays, every Friday, all over the world, to remind the adult portions of humanity that climate change endangers their future and all subsequent generations. We still have a few fun holidays, and that's a quote, left on the daily calendar. Today, September 5th, is Cheese Pizza Day, and also Be Late for Something Day. I am going to heed being late for something, because I seem to have obliviously sailed past International Left-Handers Day, which, since 1976, is annually August 13th, which, I admit, is inexcusable for me to not deify all Southpaws Saints Day, because I have, since birth, been on the counterclockwise trajectory of life. I am left-handed, a freak of nature. Every day is left-handed day to me. Yet in the world at large, we lefties are a minority, subject to rancor and scorn. In politics and society, as well as in traditional bigotry, the left is regarded as inferior and the right as superior, which I believe is terribly wrong-sided and certainly unfairly prejudicial. Lefties are said to be prone to schizophrenia. Of course we are. To be one thing, but coerced or forced to be another, is a schism that is frenetic. And perhaps those most schizoid among us are the children who have been forcibly changed to upright right-handed folk, which has been done for millennia. Religions consider us Satan's children. To be sinistro manual in a right-winged world takes a great deal of ambidexterity. For us lefties, majority rule is a bane and a pain. Any wonder why left prefers socialism? I don't know why most people are right-handed, 5%. Because they are, the right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, vile, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply bad luck is the left. My personal introduction to being unworthy was when Catholic nuns vigorously attempted to transfigure me into a righteous right-handedness and accused me of being a son of Satan when I squawked and howled in dissent. In politics as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft is made between right and left. The established order that resists change and reformation is the political and cultural right, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left is the force of change and regeneration that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of the cosmographical citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The left, as a political movement, is contrapositional. Once in power, its proponents too often subvert rightward until it is, in turn, resisted by another political left. Reform, resistance and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States and worldwide has since at least the Russian Revolution a century ago been called by assaulted authority leftist, a sinister, from Latin sinus, meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies set to destroy the American way of life operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to autocratic authority, injustice, and or inequality is, in this land of liberty, justice, and equality, implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supportive of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberation. Left-handed persons share with women and minority races and religions, also people with physical and mental disabilities, the problems of survival in a world designed with little or no consideration for their presence in it, or designed to eradicate their presence. And now, The Pursuit of Happiness by Gerald Mazzarella, which was published in the North Coast Times Eagle in summer 1969. He died that year, and this is the only essay he ever submitted to be published anywhere. Gerald was a logger and later a tree faller for an urban tree management firm. He lived and died in Astoria. The Pursuit of Happiness by Gerald Mazzarella. Life, as it applies to a society, is defined as a mode or manner of existence. Liberty as freedom from arbitrary or despotic government or control, interference, obligation, restriction, etc. The power or right of acting according to choice. Happiness as a state or quality of pleasure or contentment. My observation is that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are, one and all, subjective references, and no matter how well intended, high-sounding, or defined by further subjective means, limited by vision and intent. We may speculate as to intent, but I feel the final analysis must consider its design beyond assumption of intent and implementation. Is a society defined by its mission, declarations, or by a select few in power who coin the statement and redefine it infinitely by inherence of that power? Not unlike the assumed purity of the Socratic dialect, which professes to provide equal effort to the analysis of the pros and cons of a specific issue, we must first accept the premise that participants are not marginalized by their experience and are of no opinion or capable of transcending all such marginalization. This assumed impartiality, in my opinion, has no basis in truth, ignoring the potential of this as well as other assumed or implied intents established as truths that should be seen as subjective rationalizations. Our disappointment and sense of betrayal generated from these subjective rationalizations lies in a lack of awareness of, or distinction between, that which we aspire to in its truly idealistic state and that which is attainable given the prevailing and consequently less than idealistic circumstances. In this light, freedom can be said to be limited to the vision of its progenitors and their specific agenda, having little or no intrinsic value. Does this justify those who deliberately move to limit the greatest of possibilities or suggest we should settle for the lesser of evils rather than aspire to the grander potential? In fact, what I intend is to generate a clear understanding of the two so that no one accepts one believing it to be another. If the law of the land states that all of its citizens are free and equal under its protection and subsequently allows slavery and rampant unfair privilege, it contradicts itself, having no integrity by design or implementation. As to history, when government conspires with any faction of its constituency to undermine or prevent any or all of its remaining constituents from their rights to equitable treatment as specified in its declaration of intent, or acts in such ways, as Thomas Jefferson put it, becomes destructive to these ends regarding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, such government and those in collusion with it are, in my view, guilty of treason, inasmuch as treason is defined as the betrayal of a trust. Unaffected citizens, having knowledge of these tribulations, refusing aid and support to the afflicted, and ultimately the condemnation of such practices, are guilty of treason by omission. The evils of society are equal to the betrayal of its governing body toward the least of its citizens. Regarding our rights, Jefferson goes on to say that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. It seems evident that Jefferson was aware of the possibilities of all experiments in government to become destructive, and what the rights of the people are when faced with these circumstances. Capitalism, without concern or caution, has resulted in a resource-devouring menace wherein the wanting of bigger and more, the existing production consumption at all cost paradigm, outweighs all other considerations and reduces us to an unevolved species, unaware of our potential, aspiring to the least of our possibilities. Any system that by design creates an adversarial relationship among its citizens, only pretending at a level playing field while ultimately betraying its masses, defines irresponsibility, taking its place in a critically evaluated perspective as a social failure. Those who, by virtue of wealth and privilege, speak of the poor and homeless as persons who choose to be in the predicament, implying laziness or predisposition to drugs and other illegal activities, would be advised that large numbers of people choose to reject the inherent evils of these systems and wish to live marginally sustainable lifestyles for the sake of integrity and knowledge of a greater good. Those who claim the backlash of such systems are the result of victimization at the hands of so-called criminal elements might do well to understand the natural instinct to strike back at oppression, which is generally admired during revolutions against oppressive governments when heads roll and palaces are stormed in response to the same kinds of insensitivity. Many marginalized people without benefit of privilege or good counsel, believing they have little or no options, fall through the cracks to the waiting arms of subversive groups spawned by their own dissatisfaction with the status quo. Escaping into the delusions of drugs and condemned for those addictions by those addicted to wealth, power, pleasure, and the general greed of the day, they strike out in what I see as legitimate recoil and are policed into submission and further victimized and stigmatized when the real responsibility for their actions is to be found in a government that cares so little as to ignore these obvious cracks, except in lieu of profitable, ever-growing penal system where the offenders are forced into labor at nominal wages. Reductions in aid to needy families and the general poor, as well as denial of unemployment claims, forces large numbers of people into temporary, on-call, part-time, low-paying jobs without medical or retirement benefits. And while this looks good on paper, it creates an ever larger number of desperate working poor who, when their shaky bottoms fall out, turn to whatever means available for their survival. A few charity meals during the holidays and Toys for the Tots in concert with the $70 billion in contributions to religions in a single year alone might assure some good night's sleep and a slice of heavenly pie in the sky for the charitable, but are of no value to the less fortunate when the winds of deprivation blow the remaining 11 months of the year. I fail to see this America having any similarity to the one Jefferson hoped and intended would become a beacon to mankind, saying in a letter to Hunter in 1790, "It is indeed an animating thought that while we are securing the rights of ourselves and our posterity, we are pointing the way to struggling nations who wish, like us, to emerge from their tyrannies also." And that was Jefferson. It is incomprehensible that a society can become so immersed in its greed that it would fail to recognize and sustain its humanity. But I am guilty of assuming there is an implied humane characteristic to yet another subjective rationalization, not unlike the elusive pursuit of happiness. Yet, as William Grider writes, who will tell the people a language of democracy? Perhaps this language is subjective in nature, and that is as it should be. As the noble hearts of humanity speak of their aspirations, rising to the cause of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these greater goods, this language of democracy remains our hope, with faith and renewed courage and ingenuity toward the possibility that all of the people, regardless of class, can define their experience. These ideals and the promise of democracy can survive. And that is The Pursuit of Happiness by Gerald Mazzarella. And it appeared in the North Coast Times Eagle, July, August, 1999. And in that same issue, a poem by Gerald A. Forsyth, The World Savers. Some trample hope with apathy in pursuit of their own greed. Few really see what's happening, confusing their wants with need. But woe unto the world saver, trying to raise consciousness levels. For you, no opposition waver from those whose greed names you all devils. Summing your life up as sorrow, wondering whose plan you'll borrow, knowing you'll never achieve, yet granting yourself no reprieve. Wishing every human could see that which you've always known to be, watching with absolute horror while those pursue the suicidal path they chose. Good luck with the pain. Just pray that you'll die before your poor brain finds the answer to why. Express it in anger. Release it in rage. Poor little world saver. They never will change. And that is The World Savers by Gerald A. Forsyth. Now, Gerald Forsyth, spelled with a J rather than a G, as was Gerald Mazzarella's name. Gerald with a J, Forsyth, was about 7'7" tall and was raised in Southeast Asia by missionary parents. He traveled all over and became a very spiritual and very good-humored man. He was stricken with a life-crippling disease, and I do not know if he is still alive. Both G and J, Geralds, lived in Astoria and might have known each other. And now, something I wrote. Wednesday next is 9/11. 46 years now since the United States helped engineer the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Chile on September 11, 1973, in much the same manner as it had earlier assisted in the destruction of democratic governments in Iran and Guatemala, and was just then exiting the disastrous Vietnam War it had fought unsuccessfully for nearly a decade to deny Vietnamese unity, which had been the main purpose of defeating French colonialism in 1954. Although American intelligence agencies continue to deny overt participation in the actual military coup against the government of Chilean President Salvador Allende, extensive evidence, and that's a quote, indicates distinct U.S. complicity as well as oblique involvement in the imprisonment, torture, murder, and disappearance of several thousand Chilean civilians afterward. A greater number than the officially listed 3,000 Americans who were killed on September 11, 2001. The CIA in particular participated in black propaganda against Allende to destabilize his government and help create the conditions that fomented the coup, just as it had 20 years earlier against the government of Mohammad Mossadi in Iran and the so-called leftist government of Jacobo Arbenz Guzman in Guatemala in 1954. U.S. President Richard Nixon, who was himself deposed by his own malfeasance the following year, had worked to create conditions of economic warfare to oust Allende's quote-unquote Marxist government from the Western Hemisphere. Fidel Castro's communist Cuba was more than enough and virtually impenetrable, and Nixon immediately recognized the junta government of General Augusto Pinochet. The Nixon White House had feared what it claimed to be the presence of a well-functioning socialist experiment in Chile and Allende's possible alliance with Castro. Yet before the 9/11 coup violently purged Allende's popular unity government, Chile had been regarded as a beacon of democracy and stability for decades, certainly U.S. sanctioned. Allende gave a final speech during air raids and ground assaults against his presidential palace on 9/11 day. He vowed to stay to the death and refused offers for safe passage if he chose exile. At first, it was thought that Allende had been killed in action during the final attack upon the palace, but it seems he committed suicide. U.S. fears of an irreversible Marxist regime in Chile, again a quote, died with Allende. It was certainly true that he had promoted socialism against U.S.-backed client capitalism in Chile. He had nationalized copper, which was Chile's main mining resource, and also nationalized banks and industries, many of which were U.S.-owned. But most likely, his ultimate criminal act to adherents of neocolonialism was that Allende ardently promoted desperately needed agrarian reform. From the beginning, the military junta implemented harsh measures against its perceived opponents and nearly everyone else except the wealthy grandeeship. An estimated 1,200 to 3,200 persons were killed. A great many shot at random during military patrols and excursions throughout the country. Up to 80,000 were imprisoned, and as many as 30,000 were tortured, similar to the old Spanish Inquisition of medieval times. During Pinochet's 17-year reign, neoliberal and so-called free market capitalism, essentially under U.S. aegis, recuperated the economy for the few privileged, which dramatically worsened inequality among the previously middle classes. In the meantime, according to verifiable accounts, the junta ruled through terror and restriction of human rights and civil rights. In the 1980s, political parties formed to oppose Pinochet and the junta, and eventually wore it away without too much reprisal or bloodshed. In 2003, 30 years after the Chilean 9/11, Kenneth Maxwell, director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote in Foreign Affairs magazine that there is no doubt that the United States did all it could to create the conditions for the failure of Allende and his government. Maxwell wrote, however, that the causes of the violence in Chilean society are to be found more in Chilean circumstances than in the intent of manipulators in Washington. What is truly remarkable is the effort, the resources committed, the risks taken, the skullduggery employed, Maxwell continued, to bring a Latin American democracy down, and the meager efforts since to build democracy back up. Left to their own devices, Maxwell wrote, the Chileans might have just have found the good sense to resolve their own deep-seated problems. Allende might have fallen by his own weight, victim of his own incompetence, and not become a tragic martyr to a lost cause. But what is very clear in all this is that the coup was exactly what Richard Nixon wanted, Maxwell wrote. As Nixon put it in his own ineffable style, it's that son of a bitch Allende. We're going to smash him. The late Senator Frank Church said in 1976, like Caesar peering into the distant colonies from Rome, Nixon said the choice of government by the Chileans was unacceptable to the President of the United States. The attitude in the White House seemed to be, if in the wake of Vietnam I can no longer send in the Marines, then I will send in the CIA. And that was Frank Church. Octavio Paz wrote that Latin American democracies continue to falter because they attempt to mimic democratic forms without, quote, the critical and modern intellectual current out of which Western democracy grew. The counterpoint is that most Latin American democracies falter because the northern giant suppresses any genuine liberation movement that might challenge its supremacy in the hemisphere. Comic opera dictators might ruthlessly rule their peoples without interference as long as they maintain U.S. commercial and political dominance in their nations. True democracy in Latin America has long been considered inimical to U.S. interests, and most opportunities for critical and modern intellectual currents of democratic development are usually suppressed. Yet democracy incites ever-increasing numbers despite the brutal response of American puppets and despite its own callous repression of libertarian movements, covertly or overtly. The U.S. is often the model of independence sought by indigenous rebels. If the United States truly intends to eventually democratize the Western Hemisphere, it must first quit exploiting and treating as less than equal the other people who live here. That would require acting as if the Americans really do believe in democracy. And something of a postscript. Both the 9/11s of 1973 and 2001 occurred on a Tuesday. This is Michael McCusker. Remember, the annual fall KMUN pledge drive starts this Sunday morning. Don't forget, and pledge, pledge, pledge for free radio Pacific Coast.